Welcome to SILRAP Podcasts. You are about to listen to a service of the Center for International Law Research and Policy.
Thanks again, Morten, for the honor of being able to do this. And as I did in India, thanks to SILRAP and to the International Nuremberg Principles Academy for putting together these wonderful panel discussions and 2 days of great insights from all of you. I was typing furiously away right up until the moment that he asked me to come up here and do this. So I'm going to, change to read mode if I can, and hopefully I can read this. Now, at the last SILRAP conference in New Delhi, I spoke about the trilogy of SILRAP conferences from June through now. As Morten mentioned earlier, the quality control and preliminary examinations that we had in The Hague, the philosophical foundations of international criminal law in New Delhi, and then now the power conference that we're having. 4 months of some incredible gatherings about different aspects of ICL. I have been struck by how appropriate the locations have been for these conferences. As the preliminary examinations conference was about the inner mechanics of ICL, and in particular the ICC, what better place to have the conference than The Hague, where the machinery of ICL operates on a daily basis. New Delhi was an inspiring choice to hold the Philosophical Foundations Conference, I submit to you, given the deep philosophical, spiritual roots of India. So we saw, and we had discussions about the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, of which, of course, the Bhagavad Gita is a part. We discussed the great Indian emperor Ashoka's renunciation of war and the philosophy of Gandhi, informed, actually, by the Gita, whose life and lessons played such a large role during our deliberations. And now, here we are in Florence to discuss power in international criminal justice. Again, the perfect venue. Of course, when we think of Florence, we think of the Medici family. Much has been made of them as bankers, but they were a tremendous force in terms of political and institutional power, not just financial. They first attained wealth and political power in Florence in the 13th century through success in commerce and banking, granted. But beginning in the 1400s, with the rise to power of Cosimo de' Medici, Cosimo the Elder, the family's support of the arts and humanities made Florence into the cradle of the Renaissance, a cultural flowering rivaled only by that of ancient Greece. The Medicis produced 4 popes, and their genes have been mixed into many of Europe's royal families, including Queen of France. But the Medicis' power was challenged here with the rise of Savonarola. The Medicis were toppled, and with Savonarola being toppled, a new independent Republic of Florence was established, and Niccolò Machiavelli was made an official of this new republic in the early 1500s. He carried out diplomatic missions in this capacity and saw another side of power in this region, the brutal power grabbing of Cesare Borgia and his father, Pope Alexander VI, who were trying to bring a large part of central Italy under their possession. In August 1512, the Medici, backed by Pope Julius II, used Spanish troops to defeat the Florentines. And after the Medici victory, the Florentine city-state and the Republic were dissolved. Machiavelli was deprived of his office, and he was accused in 1513 of conspiracy against them. He was imprisoned and tortured. And it was at this time here in Florence that he wrote the great treatise on power, The Prince. The descriptions within The Prince have the general theme of accepting that the aims of princes to maintain power can justify the use of immoral means to achieve that end. And so that, I think, has hung over all of our proceedings in the last 2 days. Moving to modern times, at connecting power to international criminal procedure and law, we have also heard of the connection to the great jurist Antonio Cassese, who was here in Florence. He was the first president of the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, serving that capacity from 93 to 97. And he continued as a judge through February 2000 and was appointed the first president of the Special Tribunal for Lebanon in March 2009, resigning on health grounds, sadly, and then being succeeded by our dear judge, David Barbarano, who's here with us. Antonio Cassese has always been a hero for me and provides a great model for judging in international criminal law. So again, the connection to Florence seems particularly powerful. So I think that Florence was an inspired choice, even though it happens to be where Morton lives, and I think it was very convenient in many ways, and it was wonderful to see where he lives and for the tours that he gave us. That's been another really important part of these last 2 days. But as I suggested in my previous remarks, I see this as a trilogy and a very concentrated period of work. Morton has kept us busy, those of us who participated in all three conferences. But I think this intense period of work has been a blessing. Through the crucible of concentrated analysis on international criminal law these past 4 months, we have been through an analytical triptych of different angles of ICL. For the preliminary examination conference in The Hague, we were dealing with how the machinery of ICL works. In New Delhi, for the philosophical foundations, we considered, if you will, the ghost in the machine. And here in Florence, for this conference on power, we have been looking at who operates the machinery. So what have we learned about operation of the machine these past 2 days? First, let me state how refreshing it has been to have this interdisciplinary approach to the topic. We've heard from anthropologists, sociologists, political scientists. We've talked about art. We've talked about great literature. We've talked about political structures and history. It's been an incredibly enriching experience. And I think, as we've seen with the previous conferences, the organization and the selection of topics has been really crucial in the success of this. The first panel was on towards the topography of power in international criminal justice. Morton gave us a great conceptual overview of the problem with helpful references to power as conceptualized by Nietzsche, Weber, and Russell. And he made us understand how relevant this magnificent fresco is to our discussions here the past couple of days. I then provided a case study to help contextualize and instantiate his conceptual framework. The second panel was on the relevancy of the civil law common law divide. Judge Perrin de Brichambeau helped us understand a kind of power struggle at the heart of ICL, the push and pull between civil law and common law influences. It would seem that there has been a kind of hybridization, but at the same time, civil law influences would seem to have come into the fore. Alex Heinze helped us understand that perhaps we should not be so focused on the supposed divide between common law and civil law. Perhaps we need new vocabulary and a new way of conceptualizing the predominance of this hybridization. Our next panel was on professionals, networks, and bureaucratic domination. Mikkel Christensen began by analyzing power position in professionals in international criminal justice with a fascinating set of poles, or dichotomies, if you will, by which to understand the relevant relationships. Bureaucracy versus norms, academia versus society, local versus cosmopolitan, and law versus politics. Susan Land then just gave us a personal account of how power affects individual actors in ICL. She made us realize that experience, competence, and talent can be trumped at times by sexism, national power plays, and the vagaries of individual irrational preferences by decision makers. Bill Wiley helped us see through his experience with SILJA that actors in ICL do not have to be limited to public institutions, and gave us a fascinating case study of what can be done outside of the traditional institutions that we've been focusing on. And Kirsty's talk on power in the institutions of international criminal justice reminded us of what the subtitle of this conference is about, towards a sociology of international justice. Her tying the analysis we have seen so far to the discipline of sociology, in particular a trenchant analysis I felt on the work of Emile Durkheim as applied to ICL was very illuminating. The next panel dealt with representational, symbolic, and visual power in international criminal justice. And Dr. Sobelberg's paper on representational power in international criminal justice enlightened us regarding the power of one of the central actors in the ICL process, courts, in the writing of history through adjudicating ICL cases. Barry Sanders' talk on international criminal justice and the symbolic power of the anti-impunity mindset shows how complex measurement of ICL effects on society can be. Is ICL the ideal way of using resources for post-conflict societies? It's not entirely clear, but I think Barry's presentation was thought-provoking and will help us, I think, in all of our research going forward. Sarah Jane Coolen's presentation on visuality, power, and authority in international criminal justice shows how the idea that effective power can have a role in ICL should be studied further. This is a human institution, after all, and I think you really brought that home. I mean, it was very powerful. I loved your description of the wine and the cheese with the portraits and the discussion. I mean, it is a human institution. What motivates us? How is it that we get fired up about working on cases? And how is it that we get deterred? Thank you for bringing that into light for us. And Marina Akhtasinova's symbolic expression at the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia showed us the metamorphosis of representational power through the case study of the ICTY by the progression of the process of establishment, institutional design, rhetoric and judgments, and its framing of its failures and achievements. I think looking at it across those lines was very helpful, and it was great to have that case study. Vivian Dietrich then captured a key epistemic aspect of power in ICL, the notion of memory. And she explained that it is the fruit of a plurality of perspectives, and it is an organic living thing. It can change over time, right? Who controls it is a huge portion of the calculus of who wields power in international criminal justice. Think about your own lives. It's your memories that make you understand who you are and where you've come through, and that's probably true of international criminal justice as well. Our panel on state power and the autonomy of international criminal justice goes to the heart, I think, of what this conference is all about. Judge Barguana's insight into international lawmaking on terrorism, structural and other powers of resistance was a clarion call to all the actors in this room to take action in terms of formulating an effective response to the crime of terrorism in ICL. This helps us conceive power in a positive way, I submit to you, that can potentially engage and empower the necessary actors to solve a specific and incredibly destructive transnational scourge. Indeed, we should not just be talking about these problems, but getting out there and acting on them. Thank you for that advice, Judge. Sergei Vasilev's paper, Judicial Governance Entities as Power Holders, a Sociological Inquiry into States' Involvement in International Criminal Justice, introduced us to the notion of international justice governance institutions, which he referred to as, I want to get this right, Injugovin. What failures can be attributed to the court and which can be attributed to Injugovin? The Assembly of States Parties at the ICC has let the court down many times, but states should take responsibility rather than blame the court every time. I would note that states set up international organizations as frameworks to do their bidding. They are empty vessels in this sense. But the very states that set them up often use them as a scapegoat for their own mismal or nonfeasance within those organizations. So here, states have the court they deserve. Marika de Hoon's contribution, Diplomats as Legal Entrepreneurs, uses the evolution of the crime of aggression to help us understand the array of actors in the process in terms of norm appliers, norm invokers, norm negotiators, and norm discussants, which I think was very helpful. And then Sarah Payusko and Jacobo Gogoverna's paper, Is the European Union an Unexpected Guest at the ICC, extends the scope of actors we can identify as important players in the international criminal justice process. Their excellent joint presentation shed much light on how the EU's priorities can often be in conflict with promoting ICL, and sometimes when they coincide, it's really just a coincidence. Mark Klamberg's treatment of hegemony in ICL challenges us to understand the complex dynamic between individual agency and structural impact. Actors not only reproduce normative structures, they also change them by their very practice. This is a fascinating study in terms of realist versus liberal versus constructivist approaches to ICL. And George Dorovich's On the UNDP and the Convening of Criminal Justice for Core International Crimes gave us an important insight into how an agency we don't normally associate with ICL, the UNDP, in fact can have a large impact on the ground. Sustainable Development Goal 16, no development without peace, no peace without development, helps us understand how ICL is in its mandate, in fact. And his description of pathways for peace, inclusive approaches to preventing violent conflict, sounds like a must read. And the notion that we have to bring all parties together at the negotiating table is very powerful. Jackson Malgoto has given us the case study of the African Union and an insight into how, on a macro level, international criminal law has arguably been an exercise in New Age imperialism in Africa. And Maisha Alam's Agency, Autonomy, and Authority, the Role and Impact of Interactions with International NGOs, gave us an important insight into one of the key actors of ICL, non-governmental organizations, their influence in terms of agency, authority, and autonomy. But she also delved into the meaning of power, which I thought was very helpful, with many helpful ways of looking at it, including rationalist versus constructivist, and its multidimensional presence, power in, power over, and power to. Chris Tenove in the Agency of Victims reveals how complex the notion of victimhood can be. And is there a dynamic of domination and usurpation of the ICC in treating victims? He raised some really interesting questions in that regard. Victims have an identity and existence beyond the ICC, but the ICC does have an impact on their trajectory through the transitional justice process. And then Emma Irving's talk on social media and democratization of ICL helps us understand how actors, the media, the public, victims, witnesses, gain access to ICL through a process of communications. Crisis mapping, perpetrator exposing, victim identification, all play into this. Can social media users have an impact on case selection by the ICC prosecutor, for example? Somewhat like Bill Wiley's vision of non-public institutions impacting the ICL process, Emma's thesis makes us realize that other non-traditional actors can be an important part of the process through non-traditional means. And Bill's intervention just a few minutes ago after Emma's talk seemed particularly appropriate and instructive in that regard. And then finally, I thought Chris Mahoney's presentation on power external to international criminal justice was the perfect way to bookend the presentations. Chris explains why the cascade capture notion of Catherine Sinking, more prosecutions lead to better human rights compliance, does not necessarily work. It's not the quantity, as he says, it's the quality. And for Chris, it's about case selection. We need to bring back sovereignty as the main focus and concentrate on aggression. He gives a damning account of case studies in Rwanda, Sierra Leone, and the ICC, including Sudan and Uganda. And for the latter, complementarity gives weak states the power, he tells us, to avoid the ICC. We need to change the way we select cases. Aggression is no longer state to state. It's about states using proxies. So we need to think about using aiding and abetting against these powerful states. And we need to think about expanding the use of universal jurisdiction. So I think when we look at all these presentations, in the end, I reckon we focused on four major themes: actors, judges, prosecutors, victims, diplomats, among others, institutions, states, courts, international governmental organizations, NGOs, processes, investigations, hearings, trials, sentencing, media communications, and social codes, traditions, affects. And there I mean legal systems, rules, psychological orientation. That's my attempt to summarize it all as I'm writing all this and summarizing all of your presentations. So I may have missed some, but my sense, Morton, was that this fascinating and complex interaction of these phenomena that I just talked about has led to a very rich and fruitful discussion over the past 2 days. Let me suggest that further research could perhaps combine the inquiries of these past three conferences. As George pointed out during one of the Q&As, the work of Antonio Gramsci has sociological and philosophical implications. The idea of cultural hegemony and how it is produced and reproduced by the dominant class through the institutions that form the superstructure in his philosophy. From my own thinking, I was thinking of Nicholas Luhmann's, the great sociologist's systems theory, and the notion of autopoiesis, combining the idea of autonomy and production. Autopoiesis is the continual self-production of living systems. How does that affect international criminal law? I think it would be great to look into that. Foucault's notion of power, which we talked about at the last conference, how does that jibe with Weber's and Russell's, which was cited by Morton, for example? And then going back to the first conference, fixing preliminary examinations can be a case study in understanding the interplay between actors and structures, personal constraints and material constraints, to put it in the terms of Mark Klamberg. We began with Morton's visual of the fresco, which we all see here. Let me end with a visual from a different and more modern artist, M.C. Escher. The fresco is here in this room in Florence, but there was a great museum dedicated to the art of Escher in The Hague, the seat of international criminal justice and where the first conference in this trilogy took place. Escher's most famous works are his tessellations and his explorations of infinity. Escher does a fantastic job of creating three-dimensional worlds all wrapped up in each other, objects acting upon themselves in infinite cycles spinning out into the universe. How does that relate to our proceedings at this conference? We are here to speak about power. We have been here to speak about power. But power is not external to us. It acts on us, and in doing so changes us as we are ever in the process of changing it. Remember that many different actors in this room are not just reducing power to its intellectual essence in international criminal justice or chronicling its evolution over history. They are being affected by it themselves. So let me return to the powerful message of Judge Barugwanath. You have the ability to affect how power affects you, and you have the power to make a positive difference in the operation of international criminal justice. I hope that we all walk away here mindful of the important issues that have been raised. We have the power to make positive changes. Thank you for the great insights of this impressive gathering. I look forward to reading your papers and to seeing how your work will ultimately develop the field of international criminal justice. Thank you again to SILRAP and the International Nuremberg Principles Academy, and safe travels home. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. For more open access audio recordings, films, and publications, go to silrap.org.